Hi folks, hope all is well. This is Jim Carroll saying hello and welcome you to the latest Bantercast, the weekly podcast from the team behind the Banter series of talks and events. At Banter, we put on events in spaces and venues of all shapes and sizes, and a range of interesting people come along to tell stories, talk about their lives and discuss various topics and themes. We record what happens in the room and then we podcast the results. There are some guests we're prepared to wait for, and we've been trying to get Dorothy Cross to Banter for 4.5 years. But the dates and schedules finally aligned, and the brilliant, remarkable and forthright Cork-born artist joined us at the Sure Shot Surf Festival in the Model in Sligo the other month. It was an interview well worth waiting for. Hi folks, welcome back to Banter here at Sure Shots at the Model. My name is Jim Carroll, thank you all very much for coming along. I'm actually extremely pleased this woman here is here. I've been trying to get you to speak at Banter since, I worked this out, October 2012. So it's 4.5 years, so it's a great pleasure. Please welcome Dorothy Cross. We were talking before we started about a documentary you saw down below on the big screen. What impressed you about that one, about the women wave riders?
I'm buzzing from it. It was amazing. I don't know if any of you were watching it. It's these women who do big wave surfing. And it really makes me emotional to see people so brilliant at something and with such passion to do something. And like these waves, they're enormous. And it was very funny, too, the way the men try and keep the women out of the big wave competitions. And yes, physically, of course, they're stronger. But there's a little bunch of women, a lot of them with Irish names, actually Shocknessy, and like a whole load of them, tough as nails, fearless. And these ancient, ancient wrinkled surfers who've been around since the 60s, who never wore suntan lotion and are totally shriveled up, and talk about, you know, surfing as, you know, God walking on water, and the fact that there is no ego in surfing. And it's just completely and utterly inspiring.
Would it inspire you to kind of, I mean, give up your lure and your grow for kind of like swimming and take up like surfing instead for a while?
No, it wouldn't. My sister actually was featured earlier on in Kevin Cavey's film, because she was the Irish women surf champion in 1972. And he showed a picture of her sitting on the beach, looking very glamorous, and called her a girl surfer.
Okay, yeah. I meant to pull him up on that because it's on the website as well. But like, you know, that was his way of describing her.
I know.
Let's go back, Dorothy. Before we kind of go into the art, I'm curious about your immersion in swimming. I mean, you grew up in Cork, you grew up in Montanati, you had a house out by the sea. Your brother threw you into the sea basically to start your sea swimming. You know, swimming? Was it a release for you? Was it something that art later on replaced?
There are lots of questions in there, maybe. I think we were very privileged because we were brought up by the sea and allowed to enter into it without any fear, both on it in boats and in it with our mother, who was a beautiful diver. So I think that was a fantastic access to become fearless of that. And it is about freedom, certainly, being underwater. I was a swimmer. I was a competitive swimmer from the age of 11. I won the under 11 50 meter Irish breaststroke championship in Butlin's holiday camp. And that was my claim to fame. And Butlin's was much more exciting than the swimming in those days. But and then I competed until I was 18 kind of failed. I often speak of this because my brother was a national coach and still actually coaches a Munster swimming team. And I heard him speaking to the British coach, who said, "Why did Dorothy not improve?" And he said, "There's a saying that you go through hurt, pain and agony in training." And he said, "You know, I'd go into hurt, I'd sometimes touch pain, but I never went into agony." And it's true about that kind of speed sport. You have to be incredibly, what you do to your body is extraordinary. And maybe I was just too lazy or soft on myself. But what it did for us as a sport, as kids, was it really disciplined you. And you were up every morning for 360 days of the year in the pool at 7 till 8:30 before school. You had 5 days off at Christmas, and it took you weeks to regain that fitness that 5 days made you lose.
Did you watch kind of like swimming on TV? Did you watch swimming when the Olympics come around?
In those days, we didn't have a TV. We didn't get a TV. I had to go to my cousin's to watch Mr. Ed, the talking horse.
Okay.
But in black and white. But so yes, my brother got us up to watch. Maybe it was Tokyo, in the middle of the night. And then I was training for Munich and missed it by 0.1 of a second, the 100 meters breaststroke, the qualifying time.
Wow.
Again, because I didn't go into agony.
Okay. All right. Okay.
Let's leave the agony aside for the time being. Let's move on to kind of like the art. You know, let's move on to kind of like you started in Crawford, then you went to Leicester, and then you went on to San Francisco. Like, was there some sort of epiphany when you were a kid that kind of like took you down this road? Why did you decide to go to art school?
Well, when I was a kid, I was kind of it was like swimming and art were the things, like drawing and painting in those days. And I used to go in for the Texaco children's art competitions, and I won a few of them. So it was kind of like, it was, I really enjoyed it. I was very illustrative in those days. You know, I painted things like the Three Witches of Macbeth and Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. And it was all very allegorical and poster paints.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I went to, I didn't think that art education existed in Ireland, so I applied to places from Iceland to South Africa. And in those days, because I had been a swimmer, I believed that you would get scholarships to be an artist as well. But it wasn't the same kind of glamour. So I went in the end to Leicester Polytechnic, which was totally unglamorous, in the middle of the 70s, in the times of the Birmingham bombings, and I did three-dimensional design. By accident, I fell into the design school because I didn't know where I was. I was 18, I hadn't a clue what I was doing. And I ended up actually in product design, designing petrol pumps, and I went to the head of department and said, I think there's a mistake. I was terribly shy in those days. And I changed to three-dimensional design, and then didn't want to come back to Ireland, so went to San Francisco to do an MFA and got funded by a businessman. That's a story I've told before, and maybe it'll take too long to tell here, but I always suggest that you should write to rich people and say, will you give me money to do this or that?
Yeah. But it works.
And in the end, it worked for me,
yeah.
You know?
Before we kind of move on, I'm curious about Leicester. You know, I know Leicester quite well. My uncle's, my uncle and aunt used to live there, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a strange city, you know? You've got, like, I mean, there's an Irish subculture there. There's also kind of, like, I mean, a growing Asian kind of like culture, you know? What did, like, as a student coming over from Cork at the height of the Troubles, I mean, what did you make of it?
Well, I used to go to the Natural History Museum and draw orangutans at lunchtime. I was an incredibly quiet, introverted person, and read books and tried to keep my mouth shut a lot of the time, because you would get verbally abused for being Irish in those days, because people were being blasted and just up the road. But I found it a very culturally and visually ugly place. Mm. But it was good technical training for metalwork and things.
Okay, so San Francisco then? Well, you mean like?
Well, San Francisco was like, you know, my brother is a scientist, and he gave me a list of places not to swim in case I got eaten by a great white shark. And in fact, you know, the great whites do migrate down in the cold current from Northern California. So I went over and worked as an au pair for the first 6 months, but the child was like something out of a horror movie. And he used to phone me on the internal phone from upstairs and kind of go, oh, yeah, oh. And I was living in the garage. So I gave that up and then worked in a shop and funded myself through that.
Okay.
But it was the Art Institute was in the 60s, obviously. You had the I was there in the 79, 83 kind of thing. And so the flower power was gone. But it was such a beautiful city. Mm. And it's a wonder I didn't start diving then, because actually there's very good diving out there. Maybe it was the great white sharks. But it was physically, you know, naturally you can get in the car and drive to Death Valley. You're down in Yosemite. It was fantastic, you know.
Like who was lecturing you then? Who kind of had an influence on you at that stage?
Well, the people that were lecturing there didn't really have any influence. I mean, there was one guy called Jim Pomeroy who died falling over a dog, hit his head on the floor. But it was such a funny guy; it was the perfect way for him to die. But he was fabulous, and he had a great kind of tangential way of looking at art. But there were a lot of photographers there, good photographers. But I was in a printmaking department, which slowed everything down technically. And other people like David Hockney came by, you know, so we had visiting artists who came who were interesting at the time. But the big days of famous, like Rothko visited, you know, in his life, they were gone, really. It was a funny time. The 70s for art wasn't the best time in the world, really.
I'm curious about, like, I mean, when someone like Hockney calls by, when these artists call by who are actually working out there in the field and they're doing stuff, right? What do you as kind of students want for them? I mean, are you looking kind of like from them for, like, I mean, to key to kind of like how to make a living from this? Are you looking for kind of like, I mean, the key to how to develop your work as an artist, or are you just looking for something else?
Well, I think that's an interesting territory, because really, does the artist tell you anything? Is it the work that tells you something? And I think it's probably the work that tells you more than the artist does. That's where we can fall into the terrible trap of celebrity artists, mm-hmm. where now we all just want to know what people have for breakfast. But the funny thing in California was American students really get their money's worth because they pay a fortune to be students. So poor Hockney would be taken out of bed at like 8 or 9 in the morning, and he would have breakfast with the students, and they kind of used him right through the day. So there was something about hierarchically, and one way there was a leveling that occurred, because the poor man was kind of absorbed by these MFA students for 24 hours. But I think even still now, you know, obviously there are heroes, visual artist heroes. A lot of them would be dead. But the whole hero thing is interesting for me. I've met a few of them in my life, of my heroes, and sadly some of them have died recently, like John Berger. And the first time I met him, he was wearing a flowery apron, cooking dinner in Connemara. And, you know, it was just this extraordinary, you go from his, you know, illuminations in terms of his voice, his words, his writing, and then he's cooking a roast lamb. You know, it's fantastic. But then his essence was about cooking a roast lamb.
Yeah, yeah. Let's kind of move on from kind of San Francisco. You know, I mean, did you come back at that stage here? Or, like, I mean, what brought you back?
I think what brought me back was too much plastic surgery and also Ronald Reagan.
Right, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I think if I was that age now and it was Trump, I'd do the same thing.
It's funny you say that, because I mean, a lot of my friends who like would have moved to the States in kind of like me in the late 70s, early 80s, they always kind of cite the moment for them that everything changed was when Ronald Reagan was elected. Suddenly, they were kind of like seeing like, you know, like things like, I mean, the Wade versus Roe, like, I mean, up for grabs. There's all these kind of like changes in America that they suddenly didn't like. It took away. And when I see what's going on right now with Trump, as you just said right now, you can see the same parallels.
Yeah, you can, but it's worse now. It's more dangerous now. But I think also I'd been gone for 10 years. I was, you know, 'cause I was in England before I went there, so I was kind of curious about coming back to Ireland. I always had a yen for it, and it's not a nationalism, I don't think, but it's an essential thing for me. I very much yearn. You know, now where I live, I'm a blow-in in the West Coast in Connemara. But when I pass Uachtaráid and you hit those lakes and those mountains, it's just so beautiful.
Yeah.
So I don't think I would have liked to have stayed in America.
Okay, you said that the 70s was a weird time for art in America. The 80s in Ireland, was that a very weird time?
Well, I came back in 1983 and there was the divorce referendum and the abortion referendum. We haven't gone very far. Thank God, at least divorce has got there. So it was a shock. It was a total physical shock, climatically, and the church was before the fall of the church, really, and all my early work was responding to the still dominant authority of that voice, which I was so, I had forgotten. And I didn't go to a very Catholic school, so I never was impregnated with that kind of dogma, really.
Yeah.
Even though the kind of regalia of it attracted me, and the symbolism of it attracted me. So it was a dark time, and I was very broke. And the good thing was, though, that I never studied in Dublin or Ireland, so I had no allegiances or kind of, people hadn't judged me already, so I came in fresh. So I had a kind of a clear track,
yeah,
which I know, looking back, I think was good for me.
Okay. I'm curious what you said there about, I mean, the role of the church, you know, and that kind of, I suppose, that overarching kind of like symbolism. I'm thinking about what you said earlier on about the pictures you were painting, Jesus in the garden, etc. You know, that sometimes we kind of, we I'm always kind of, it's curious, you're talking there about the 80s, you're coming back, abortion, divorce, all that's kind of in the narrative, you know, and we haven't moved on that far at all. Mm. So, like, I mean, that presence of the church in your work, the presence of the church on your work, you know, do you kind of find that something that you thought at this stage would be gone?
Maybe it's transformed. It probably hasn't gone because, you know, in some ways what the church... Essentially, what the church stands for is about some kind of territory of the unknown. Maybe it got contaminated with other stuff, but that interest still follows me through. Mm. You know, does that make sense?
Makes sense. Yeah. I mean, the work you were doing, like, I mean, when you came back in the 80s, you know, did you kind of feel that you were like trying out teams at that stage? Did you have a very clear idea of where you wanted to go with things?
No, I never have a clear idea about where I'm going. I never, ever, ever still don't. And sometimes I wish I did because it would be easier to go into the studio in the morning. But I'm losing now my... What was that question?
That was... Had you a clear idea about the work you're doing?
Oh, yeah. No. I was so kind of incensed by the voice of authority of the church that I started making reactionary work. And there was a critic at the time called Joan Fowler, and she was kind of saying that maybe it was becoming too kind of didactic and reactionary. And actually, I made a piece which was called Bishop's Chair. And it had a big mitred back and a big megaphone. It had all these spikes growing up through the chair. And it was all about the discomfort we had to suffer as Catholics to be purified, to transcend into some other territoire. And my mother said, very simply, she was very interesting because she, I don't think, really understood, in inverted commas, my work at all, was fantastically supportive of it. But she said, maybe, darling, it's the suffering we have to endure to pass on, rather than the unnecessary. So I saw then, just in that tiny comment, that I was trying to make my own dogma in a funny way. So it really pulled the rug out from under my feet, amongst other things at the time. It wasn't only that comment. I think what's interesting is when you look at a piece of work, and again, this is getting back away from the artist thing, but why am I sitting here talking to you, really, though, too? Like, this is another question. If I, you know, why does an artist show themselves at all? The only reason I sit here and talk about art is I think art is incredibly valuable. And it's interesting that when people like Donald Trump come along, they immediately hack the funding for the arts.
Yeah.
We have a pathetic Minister for Education now who knows nothing about art, Heather Humphreys, and it's been put there by the Fine Gael government, and is also paying nothing to people who directed the Irish Museum of Modern Art. And it's absolutely, you know, astounding to me. But so the reason I speak is that I want to talk about, when I'm talking to younger people, I want to talk about the possibility of survival. And when I'm talking to people of my own age, I want to talk about the continued pleasure, or like when you phoned me up, you hooked me a little bit 3 years later on the phone by mentioning the word discovery. And what does art do? Or what does, you know, surfing down a 100-foot wave do? It is about some kind of discovery that is intangible, so it's not discussable. So I talk words and words and words and words and words, but I will never really talk exactly about what something is about.
Yeah, I kind of find as well, what I find fascinating about what you're saying right now is that you're not speaking in kind of art speak. You know, there's a way of speaking about art that, like, you know about this in brochures. It's the way kind of like museums and galleries operate, and that's fine, that's cool. But I'm more interested in getting behind that. One comment before we go on. I mean, when your mother's comment there about the bishop's chair you made, maybe that was the agony you were supposed to reach when you were swimming. Sitting in that chair.
But you see, no. I think a physical agony and a existential agonies are different.
Okay. All right. So let's move on. Let's move on then, because I mean, I want to kind of talk a little bit more about, like, why you are sitting here and, like, I mean, the art of discovery. But, like, you know, after those kind of, like, that didactic thing, that, like, I mean, creating the pieces about the church, then you kind of moved on to, like, I mean, pieces like this. You know, you moved on to kind of, like, you know, I know we're doing a big jump here, but like, I mean, suddenly it became, in my mind, looking back at your work, nature and the outdoors and the landscape and this oral kind of, like, mean relationship with this world suddenly began to take dominant shape in your work.
Yes, I think after the after the church stuff, there was a terrible stage that nobody's, it's all been destroyed, I'd say. And then there were cows. I worked a lot with cows udders, and the notion of gender and obfuscating the male and female, which still interests me, and that's why, you know, I love watching those gnarled old women talking about, you know, sliding down massive waves. Because it is some unifying factor. The wave is the essence there.
Yeah.
Whether you're a man or a woman, and it doesn't matter, it's the wave. But with the cow works, I worked with cow's udders for several years because I'd seen a sieve made out of a cow's udder up in Norway, and it was such an extraordinary, actually, discovery. I saw it in this little museum that was like a Bunratty folk park, and I went, oh my God, it was more exciting than going into MoMA and seeing Merritt Oppenheim's for a teacup. So that then caused me to work with udders for 2 years. Then, but that's nature. It was a cow. It was an abomination of a cow, but then I have leather shoes on, and so do you. So, but it was about the teat.
Yeah. Okay. So, like, I'm curious. When you read about that, you saw the cow's udder in a museum in Norway, right?
Yeah.
What do we use besides when the cow's alive and using it and we get milk out? What do we use udders for down here? Is there any similar use?
Well, you know, in the north they call them elders, the teats, or the whole udder they call them elders, which is a lovely poetic kind of name for them. But in northern Italy they make a ravioli out of the teats and udders of a cow. But generally speaking, they're not used.
Right.
But because when you skin a cow, you skin it down the stomach. So for leather, they're kind of discarded. But that's why I was so fascinated that the Norwegians used every part of the cow to make a sieve, with little holes drilled, and it was like a baron, and they sieved grain. So it had a secondary significance and utilitarian thing. And so that kind of use is what's fabulous. So in some ways, us talking is about another use for ourselves. And words, you know, are so dangerous. So certainty is in some ways unforgivable.
Okay. I want to kind of, what you're talking about there about us talking and you're talking about discovery, and you also kind of talk about why you as an artist are sitting here, you know, and there's something you said earlier on, you're talking about like celebrity, you mentioned Hockney, and you mentioned kind of like this whole thing about what did an artist have for their breakfast, you know. I remember very clearly, and I don't remember what you had for your breakfast when you did this piece, but like, I mean, I remember when this piece was appeared in Dublin Bay in 1999, and it was a sensation. It was kind of like, I mean, it was for a lot of people, it was a moment when they realized there was a woman called Dorothy Cross, and this work was appearing in Dublin Bay every night. You know, when you were doing this work, I mean, like, you know, obviously it was a ship, you know, it was going to be kind of moored, you knew what the process was. Did you ever think about expectations around it? Do you ever think about how it would be received?
No, I don't. No. Just to explain to people who mightn't have seen this, it was a open submission project in Dublin that was funded by Nissan Cars through the Museum of Modern Art. And it was a very simple idea to borrow, actually if you put the next image up, or the image before it, to borrow an old decommissioned lightship. It's the one with Daunt written on it. And paint it with phosphorus paint so it would glow in the dark and create a ghost. And it all sounded terribly simple, and it took 2 years, and it was a nightmare of logistics, and a nightmare of insurance, and a nightmare of civil servants, and a nightmare of heads of Nissan Cars, that can go on the record. He's retired, but it worked. It worked, and this was the ship that my father shot in the 40s, off Crosshaven, marking the Dawn Rock. And when I found the languishing red lightship in Grand Canal Dock in Dublin that I thought I'd paint, I went to his photo albums and discovered he had photographed the same ship, which was called the Albatross, that was built in Glasgow in 1928. And it had been given to the Sea Scouts just as a training vessel. So that it was a big, that piece was so difficult to get to happen. It was shelved, paint cost €140 a litre. The budget went from 40,000 to 110,000. I wasn't getting any of this money, but in the end it happened. So expectation, we did not know this would work until the night before the opening, that we went out in our little dinghies in the freezing cold in February to see would the lights work. You know, it was fantastic. It was kind of, I look back, and even a friend of mine was visiting Connemara the other day who worked on it, and it was just sailing by the seat of our trousers. We had a fantastic sea captain from Hoth who lied through his teeth to all the commissioners, because we were told we weren't allowed to go out there to monitor the, you had to have, we put a rig of ultraviolet lights. So you had a generator. We were told you couldn't go and get the generators. So we broke all the rules. But it did work. Some nights it worked better than others, and it was beautiful, and it was simple. It was very, very simple. It was a toy. It was allegorical. It was pointing towards a phantom. It wasn't a phantom. You could see it wasn't a phantom. It could have been a phantom if they had spent more money and dragged it around the whole of the island so that you could have driven your car along the Dingle Peninsula and seen this thing without any warning in the middle of the night. Then it would have been powerful. But of course, insurance, la-di-da-di-da.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, you know, I mean, if you spend 2 years working on this story, I mean, you obviously discover things about yourself as well during that process, and how kind of like pig-headed you were.
You'd have to talk to Mr. Nissan. He might have a different opinion. Pig-headed.
Stubborn.
Yeah, I love pigs, actually, so that's not a... stubborn, yes, stubborn, tenacious maybe is the word.
Okay, so after Ghost Ship, then, like, I mean, it's a huge success. It gets it's like people suddenly go, oh, Dorothy Cross, she's the Ghost Ship woman, you know. That was 1999. You moved to Killary in Connemara in 2007, was it?
2002.
Yeah. Like, I mean, after Ghost Ship, then did you and your brother? Was that when you and your brother went to?
Oh yeah, we did. Yeah. We went to Australia to make a film about jellyfish. There's a little image of that there. My brother's a scientist, and
it's Tom, isn't it?
Tom Cross is his name, and he was a swimming coach as well, and he. I'd heard there was money available through the Wellcome Trust in England, who fund scientists and artists to work together. And I said to him, would you like to work on a project about jellyfish? Because I had heard the story, we need to be here for 10 hours, about a woman who bred jellyfish on an island, on Valentia Island, called Maud Delap. And she did it in her father's, in bell jars in her father's kitchen. Her mother was dead and she was unmarried. And she managed to breed jellyfish without any scientific help in her kitchen. So I was looking at the history and memory of her story. So I said to my brother Tom, let's get money. It was a really nice pitch. I would go into the history and memory of Maud. She, in her later life, was made a member of the Linnaean Society for her works, but she did it all on her own back. She went out in her big dress, you know, to catch plankton to feed the jellyfish. And then my brother, who is a geneticist, really, I thought genetics were visually a little bit boring, so we decided we'd look at the biomechanics of Chironex fleckeri, which is a box jellyfish who lives off Australia and causes a lot of deaths, has killed more people than shark and crocodiles put together, actually. So we did this little film together called Medusa.
Right. Okay. There was also an opera as well. You did.
Oh yeah.
I kind of found that's a beautiful idea. You know.
That was my favorite thing actually. It was an opera called Chiasm that we did in, if you want to call it an opera, it was kind of a music thing, where I extricated phrases of love and loss from about 20 different romantic operas. You know, from Mozart to whatever, like all different languages, all different eras of music, Monteverdi, whatever. And I had a soprano in one handball alley and a tenor in the other, divided by a big wall, and we projected the worm's hole, Pala na Beisht, from the Aran Islands, into the floor of the handball alleys and mirrored them. So you had these two people separated, singing about love and loss, and you never knew when they were going to start meeting at the wall between them, so I didn't choreograph them. And that, actually, the handball alleys are still there. They're in St. Enda's School in Galway, surprisingly, with all the boom and knocking down of things. They're very beautiful architecturally. Yeah. And I'm working on a project at the moment that involving music as well, but and this is interesting at this stage. You know, Chiasm worked. It worked again with, again, you know, there was a strike for, we had to get climbers to go up on cherry pickers to have the projections because there was a scaffolding strike, you know. So you have all these other things that occur when you're trying to make something beautiful. But with Chiasm, what was beautiful was they were walking on the moving pool, singing about love and loss, and they could have met at the wall at one point, but they never did. So it was about this beautiful kind of operatic possibility, and you could watch it over and over again, and they were never on the pool in the same position ever throughout the sequences. But I'm trying to do something on a Navy ship at the moment, but this is where it's difficult, and I'm getting kind of grumpy in my old age, because I'm so sick of having to fight against bureaucracy, and it's getting worse. That's an awful thing for younger artists, I think. It's getting worse. Health and safety is killing everything. And they really need to start looking at what they're doing to... they'll all have solid straitjackets in another while. But, I'm working with singer Lisa Hannigan. And, glass harmonica player called Alistair Malloy. And we're hoping to do something on this Navy ship in September, but there's so many no's occurring that it mightn't happen. But then the ghost ship was like that. It's actually like, God almighty, how many years later, nearly 20 years later.
Is this for the safe harbour?
Yes, sounds from a safe harbour.
Safe harbour, okay, great. Yeah. Okay, so you moved into Connemara in 2002, and you said in all interviews you moved there to swim. You know, it was swimming which attracted you.
Oh, to dive, actually, to dive.
Right. To dive, yeah.
Yeah, there's a brilliant dive centre there run by the Greys called Scuba Dive West, and it's at the mouth of Killary Harbour, and I had learned to dive in the Galapagos Islands when I went there travelling when I was younger. And I had never qualified, so when I came back to Ireland, I qualified and did my final dives with them, and found that the North Atlantic diving is extraordinary too. So in the summer of 95, I camped on Glaslawn Beach and dived every day until my money ran out. And then a couple of years later, found some land before I actually moved, and bought the land and still rented places in Dublin. And then moved lock, stock and barrel in 2002.
Okay, Aidan Dunn in a piece about Connemara talked about your prediction for sheds. It's almost like I often kind of find when people write some things, they often leave X's in the text, and these X's are for people like me when we're following up, and we kind of go, sheds, what's the significance of sheds? Didn't go into it. Well, so what is the significance of your sheds?
Not being allowed to build a house, simply. Actually, in the beginning I had a tent, then I had a shed, then I had a second shed, and then I bought a house across the road. But but they're lovely. There's something simple about them.
Yeah.
And they're closer to the sea, so you can hear the sea. Mm.
Speaking on the kind of discovery team, I love the fact that so much of the work in Connemara, the exhibition Connemara, was stuff you literally discovered when you were walking by the sea.
That's right. Yeah. I did a show in RHA called Connemara, and which I think it is a very goofy title. It's so kind of Bord Fáilte-ish. But
was there something that someone at a Tate or in the UK gallery said that when he heard the title Connemara, he expected green grass and stone walls?
Oh, really? I didn't hear that one. But it was first shown in England in Margate and Turner Contemporary. And what was very nice was Turner was being shown in one wing and I was being shown in the other. And they allowed me infiltrate the Turner territories with cast foxgloves with fingers. So it was a beautiful kind of merging of the history of Turner. And it's happening again, actually, next September. And the Tate do a lot of these. They lend out to more contemporary institutions in England. And there's one with my friend Tacita and Cornelia Parker, and we're making works with Turners again in Warsaw in a new art gallery, it's called. But I love that kind of coming together of what's old and new.
Yeah.
And the breaking down then of some sense of chronology or some sense of the contemporary. Because if you think about it, what is contemporary, what will be contemporary, you know, what's historic, it's all means it's meaningless, really. If the work has any power, I would like to think it will survive in a kind of timeless way.
Yeah.
And not a fashion way. You see, the problem is fashion.
Yeah, the problem is fashion, because I remember seeing Connemara. I mean, the one of the most striking pieces was the cork in the middle of it, you know, and the way it was. And you kind of said as well, when you bought the cork, that the holy water or the rosy beads was inside it already.
Yeah.
A flashback to the work in the 1980s, you know. But fashionable, you know, you're looking at kind of that is so of its time, but yet it's so timeless as well.
Well, hopefully, yeah. This was a piece where I was getting corks for an opera I was doing in English National Opera of Riders of the Sea with my friend Fiona Shaw, and we had these six corks float in. It was absolutely beautiful from at the end of Riders of the Sea with the drowned Bartley on the stage. But so I got a surplus of corks, and because some of the local guys were bringing me extra corks, so I turned one up upside down and made a little kind of a almost like a little cinema out of it, and I called it Tabernacle. And that's where like kind of language and image or physical thing come together, because I didn't know at the time that, well, I thought the tabernacle is the holy, you know, where you have in a Catholic church, you put Jesus' body and blood is located there. But also a tabernacle originated through Judaism in the desert, was where the spiritual source was. I mean, it could even be a tent. But the third thing is a tabernacle is a groove in a boat where the mast is held. So this beautiful kind of trilogy of meaning. And I put little benches in there so you could sit under the curragh as if you were inverted into some, what is it, is below the water or are you in outer space? And then you viewed a vertical video of a cave that is actually in Connemara that I'm familiar with, that it's tidal. You can only get into it rarely, rarely. And it's so beautiful because as you walk out, the light comes in. So you're sitting in this vertical little cinema watching this beautiful kind of water lapping in and out of this cave. So it's a strange little kind of loop, but yeah.
Okay. Do you get to see the swim every day?
No, I don't. No, I'm a wuss on that. But I wish I did actually, because everybody thinks I do, and I know. So now that I'm on Instagram, I watch a lot of these wild swimmers who do amazing swimming. So I keep thinking I should do more of it, because it's so lovely when you do. But I think you have to train your body up to not feel the cold, you know, and I do feel cold. Like when I dive, I wear a dry suit, obviously.
You mentioned Instagram there, and we were talking earlier on, you were kind of saying you don't spend as much time online, maybe, you know, you spend time online to obviously process requests for work or proposals for work, you know. But I like your Instagram feed. It's very much like, now having met you, I can kind of see where the images are coming from in many ways.
Yeah, I kind of treat it as a sketchbook. And people say to me, do you waste time? And yes, you do, I guess, waste a certain amount of time on it. Because you do get a little bit, in the beginning I got quite addictive, but what it makes you do now with the modern camera and the phone in particular being so fast, is it does make you edit, and that's really interesting. You go, that's an interesting one. And then it makes you pause, so it's good on that level. It makes you pause for a moment, and you put it up, and if there's something really, really good, I won't put it on there, I'll keep it for work. But sometimes I'm working on a little film for the Seamusini Museum in Balaki, and I was absolutely, you know, losing sleep over it, because he was such a wonderful man, and there has to be so much respect, and how on earth can you in any way make anything that is not a waste of time in relationship to his life, and how dare you in a way? So I started looking at the separation between the word and the image, and how, in some sense, I believe the word can pollute the image, and the image can pollute the word. And if you look at a lot of kind of, TV documentaries, they put, you know, if it's a poet, you know, and he's talking about a river, there's a picture of a river, and you go, oh my God, you can't hear the word river, and you can't see the river. And, you know, you've nature programs, and you've gorgeous David Attenborough talking away, and then you've ghastly orchestral music over the top. So you're bombarded with levels and layers and layers. So what we're trying to do is separate those things. And I started looking at what I was putting on Instagram and taking out fragments, because I read poetry fragmentally. I'll read through one poem and hear a phrase and then miss the next few. So in some ways, it's then you flip to an image. So it's very, very interesting that, you know, I have been scrolling back on my little Instagram thinking, rather than having to go through 10,000 million photographs on my computer to try and find the ones that have resonated, you know?
It's interesting what you said there about, like, I mean, that breakup between the image and word, and, like, I mean, modern web page design, the way it's designed is almost like, I mean, you got to cut the words, then the image comes in to almost like compensate for what's not there.
Compensate?
Yeah. Compensate. Maybe that's the wrong word. Okay, I'm very aware of the fact that we've been talking to kind of 40 minutes, and I haven't answered any questions you asked me earlier on about why you're here, you know. So maybe you can answer some of the questions about why you're here. And like again, I'm kind of throwing it to the big theme of these sessions, which is discovery. You know, when you kind of look back on your work, and I know no artist likes to look back on their work because it's always about what comes next, you know. But what do you think you've kind of discovered about yourself? I mean, when you look back to the young swimmer back in Cork, like, and where you are today in terms of the work you've done. I mean, what do you think you've discovered about yourself?
But I don't think it matters.
If that's a policy question, say so.
It doesn't matter what I've discovered about myself, really. I think what's interesting is looking back and seeing what excited one at a certain point in one's life, still being excited if one looks back. Like, I looked at the Medusa film recently that was made 15 years ago, and there's some beautiful sequences. I have a terrible memory. I forget everything. So that's, and also to believe that you can still be excited.
Yeah.
And the discovery thing that, you know, that was stuck in my head, you see, discovery is more, it's always about, not knowing that you know less than you think you know, if you know what I mean. So
yeah.
Discovery, then you have to wait for the next discovery. So discovery is only a step. But, you know, it's something to do, it's about dualities. It is about the word and the image in some ways. But I remember once when I got back home late one evening, in Connemara, my friend Tanya called and said, there's a pilot whale beached on Glasalon. So I went down, this poor animal had died. And at that moment, my cousin phoned me from Cologne Opera House. He's an opera director. And he had his mobile phone on, and he was playing Die Valkyrie in rehearsal in Cologne. And there's that moment, you know, that's the kind of, the moment of Die Valkyrie coming together with the dead pilot whale, the kind of, like, nearly crying, watching those women going down the face of a monstrous wave, nearly crying next to the beautiful pilot whale, and then having the real-time Die Valkyrie occur. You know, there's something about a discovery about, and it's about embodiment and disembodiment at the same time. Maybe, is that what it's about?
Maybe, yeah. I like the way you kind of put the music and the visual image together there in terms of the poor whale on the beach and the music coming in from Cologne.
But he could have phoned me. I could have been in the car going home. But it was about being on my own on that beach, with the whale and my cousin's rehearsal. You know, there was something that is about a moment in time that occurs that might be a discovery, but it passes very, very quickly, and then you want another, you want to have access another discovery. And that's where one hopes that art can do that for you, and you know, good art can, and it's great when you still see good art. And it might be going back to the Egyptians. You don't have to, it doesn't have to be contemporary. You might go and see Nefertiti and go, oh yes, this is extraordinary, and you have forgotten it's extraordinary, and it can still be new because you're somewhere else when you meet Nefertiti the second time. Mm. You know what I mean?
Exactly. It's the way you were when you come into the room after seeing that documentary. I mean, it's how it affects you at a certain time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dorothy Cross, a pleasure meeting you, and thank you very much for coming along to Banter. Dorothy Cross.
Thanks to Dorothy for joining us in Sligo, and thanks to Aidan, Shane and Al at Sure Shots for the invitation to come to Sligo and all their help and hospitality. The Bantercast series producer is Tanya White. Check out thisisbanter.com for news we're up to at Banter, plus you can also listen back to all the Banter podcasts to date. We'll be back next week with another podcast. Until then, goodbye and take care.